Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking in urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to this edition of City Talks. Today, my guest is Dr. Max Nathan. Max is Associate Professor in Applied Urban Science in the Centre for Advanced Spatial Analysis, otherwise known as CASA, at the University College London. He's got a list of associations and affiliations with other research centres and institutions, as long as my arm. And back in the day, he helped set up the Centre for Cities. Max, welcome back to City Talks.
Thanks for having me.
So our topic today is a working paper you published last summer entitled Does Light Touch Cluster Policy Work? Evaluating the Tech City Programme. Clusters and Tech City are long-term interests of yours. You've done lots of work in this sort of space. So let's just unpack the paper for a minute and start with the first idea, which is clusters. Just say something about why clusters are so enduring and attractive to policymakers in particular.
Sure. So when we think about clusters, we think about a critical mass of co-located interacting firms and the people in them. And I think there's a number of reasons why policymakers like clusters. The first is that they are, you know, an enduring feature of the urban economic landscape. Clusters like Silicon Valley, which are kind of city regional, or much smaller scale things like the City of London, have been around for a while. They're a very visible part of the cityscape. On top of that, I mean, technically clusters are production districts. That's how we think of them as academics. And one of the reasons I think policymakers like them is because they take the things that make urban economies work, you know, matching, sharing, learning effects, as we call them, and amplify and concentrate them. So they're a very, very effective sort of city in miniature in a particular sector or set of sectors. And then coming out of that, they're also symbols of prestige. So Silicon Valley is a, you know, one of the kind of jewels of the Bay Area. Mm. The City of London is something that, you know, London government talks about all the time. It's one of their kind of economic engines. And so the kind of prestige of having a cluster like that or wanting to get one is also a big part of the attraction.
And so one of the enduring features, I think, of and the attractions of clusters is, you know, they're observable, as you've said, they actually exist. We can see them, whether it's Silicon Valley or whether it's the City of London. What's the appeal to policymakers beyond the observable? So they can see them there. Is that why they get attracted to them?
It's partly a sort of signalling thing. So if you have a cluster, you're going to want to talk about it. As we'll go on to say, a big part of the Tech City programme was about place marketing and branding and sort of shining a light on what was going on. And that seems like a completely legitimate set of policy stances. I think more broadly, it's sort of tempting to take a cluster and try and make it work better, or if you don't have one, to try and build one from scratch. And in theory, there are good reasons why policymakers would want to come in. So, you know, we know that clusters are a kind of enduring feature. What we also know is that they don't completely happen on their own. They're not completely organic. So if you look at how much information managers of firms have, how well property markets work, you know, how much affordable workspace there is in clusters, there are often market and coordination failures there. So in principle, policymakers could come in and design a set of interventions or a kind of cluster master plan and make it work better. And similarly, if you think about the sort of building blocks of a cluster, you could design a policy that tries to build one of those from scratch. And this is where policymakers depart from academics. So everybody agrees that clusters are economically important. Academics, particularly economists, are much more skeptical about whether you can pull those levers or whether you can even design those levers, let alone pull them in the right sequence.
Yeah. And so just, I mean, there's a long history of, in which you talk about in the paper about, you know, economists both trying to understand clusters and articulate them in different ways and different types of clusters as well, going back at least to Alfred Marshall. Just say a little bit about the history of cluster thinking in the academic community.
Sure. So Marshall, as you say, is the sort of starting point. So he talks about industrial districts where of ideas are in the air. And so his notion of a cluster is one where there's a single industry physically co-located in a particular district or sort of network of districts. And there are advantages to being there. So you can share inputs. So if you're sort of located by a river or a stream, you know, you can draw energy from the stream. There's a labour market and a bunch of people you can buy and sell to within your production function, to use the jargon. And also you talk to people in the area and you discover interesting things that people are doing, you discover market opportunities. Those things are much easier to share face to face than they would be, reading them in a newspaper, for example. So they take, again, we're taking the sort of economic building blocks of cities, particularly the kind of serendipitous interaction, and concentrating it in a neighbourhood.
And is it about certain industries or particular depth of certain industries, or is it actually about the spread of related activity? I mean, again, there's different variations from, kind of stuff that Jacobs would often talk about compared to what Marshall might talk about, compared to what people like Porter would talk about. Right. But just outline a bit of that, the different ways we can think about clusters.
So the Jacobs step is an interesting one. So Marshall is very much focused on single industries. Jacobs in the 60s talks about cities producing new work out of old work. And the kind of intuition behind that is that it's the mix of stuff in a city which allows ideas to flow most effectively and really interesting ideas to emerge. So she's interested in hybridization. In modern language, we might talk about how one industry disrupts another,
yeah,
and how that enables innovation to happen. And so there's been a large academic literature looking at whether Marshallian or Jacobian forms of innovation and forms of clusters are the most effective in terms of economic performance. And it's, on average, both seem to matter. There's an interesting set of questions now, I think, about whether sort of post-industrial shifts in cities and globalization are starting to change that. So one vector of that is, cities have lost quite a lot of manufacturing activity, although craft forms and sort of high-tech forms are coming back at small scale. In a service-dominated city, is Marshall as relevant as he was before? And then the second part of it is about technology. So, both Marshall and Jacobs thought of clusters as part of cities which were more or less self-contained economies, or sort of largely self-contained. Given the kind of international integration of industries we have now, I think there's a legitimate question about whether you can think of clusters in that way anymore. So are they, a bounded neighbourhood, or are they part of a larger production system that might sit across several cities or several countries? And so in that kind of framing, academics talk about them as hubs in production networks.
Right. And what's your sense as to where we are? Because there's always seems to be the tension in the, in this sort of space around the value and returns from geographical concentration with, we hear this all the time, death at distance, you can spread production and or activity across the globe. So just say something about that, where we think we are with some of the work that's been produced elsewhere.
Sure. So I mean, distance, is supposed to have died a number of times. I don't think that's really happened. And if the returns to physical proximity for high-value activity, so particularly kind of knowledge-based services and stuff that big cities in the UK are pretty good at, by and large, those returns are still pretty high, and technology hasn't taken that away. What it has enabled people to do is to chop up firms into different bits and move different bits of firms across space. So if you think about banks in the City of London, the head office is going to be there, but large parts of the banking functions are going to be in Birmingham, or they'll be in call centre somewhere else, or they'll be outside the UK altogether. And, information and communication technology allows us to kind of weave those things together more or less effectively. Some banks have big IT failings and don't do that very well, but it's possible to chop up bits of the firm in a way that it was harder to do before. I think the kind of edge case is whether we'll have some technological breakthrough which is much more disruptive than that. And there are sort of signs of that starting to happen with telepresence and mobile communication platforms. But I'm not sure how close we are to that yet.
No.
Cities don't show any signs of going away.
So the central element there is there's a mix of industries, related activities being provided, but the geographical focus and emphasis is something that is quite important and, as is core to the very idea of clusters, and there is a kind of bounded nature of the geography. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it's quite difficult to think about clusters as not having a physical element at all.
Yeah,
I mean, there are some interesting researchers who look at virtual teams and virtual communities, and some of them will think about those as analogs to physical clusters. But by and large, those things are complements rather than substitutes. The interesting point will be if that starts to switch, and if online communities and ways of organising online can work for people who've never physically met.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so we're going to come to the sort of history of the tech city policy and that area in a second. But before we get to that, just say something about, or give us an overview of, I suppose, the evaluation impact or the review of literature around clusters policy to date? I mean, you talked about, you know, academics are slightly more sceptical, policymakers tend to love it. Just say what the academic community's got to say about clusters policy more generally.
Sure. I mean, the first thing to say is there's not that, actually that much evaluation. surprisingly little given the amount of studies out there about clusters in general. Academics have cut cluster policy into three families broadly. So one is about networks of firms and incentivizing those firms to interact. So this is less about building a cluster and more about building on top of sectoral linkages that are already there. That's often done at a national level rather than a local level, which is going to be important for the tech city story. And the evaluations that have been done of those programs find that they generally work. You might worry that the kind of firms in the program are going to interact with each other anyway, but if you look at the level of interaction and the level of new products and processes that come out, those seem relatively effective. That doesn't seem terribly different to business support to me, but it can have a spatial angle. The second family is about physical rebuilding. So, for example, in Barcelona, the 22@ district was an ex-industrial neighbourhood that was rezoned by the city. Incentives were put in to encourage knowledge-based services to enter, and they tried to basically rebuild the neighbourhood economy around that. And that seems to have, evaluations of that suggest that they've changed the sector mix, but it's not obvious that the area performs better than other areas like it in the city. And then the third family is the kind of Porter-style, light-touch approach, where you're basically doing a deep dive into an area, in Porter's original version, and trying to sort of map the interactions and map the economic structure. And then you do a series of light-touch things to try and get the cluster to work better. And Porter's sort of national diamond, which he uses for national competitive advantage, he applies to cities. So he sees it as a set of positive interactions that you can trigger with the right policy levers. And that's the sort of policy family which is most pervasive, but also least well understood and least well evaluated.
And when academics such as yourself, when you're just thinking more generally about, you know, thinking about whether a cluster is performing well and policy is, you know, having the desired effect, just give us a sense as to what the kind of things you're looking for on the upside, I suppose, and some of the issues you're looking for on the downside as well.
So when I think about clusters, and this builds off a paper that Henry Overman and I did a few years ago, we think about positive and negative feedback loops. So the positive feedback loop is this agglomeration effect I talked about before. So if you concentrate firms or a mix of firms into an area and let them go at it, they become more innovative and more productive. And you would expect a well-functioning cluster to raise the productivity and sort of innovativeness of companies in it. The negative feedback loops are really the flip of that. So if you dump a load of companies into an area and let them go at it, the area will also become more crowded, more congested, potentially more expensive, there may be poaching of staff, there may be displacement. And there'll also be more competition between the protagonists. So when you're thinking about whether the cluster policy works or not, you need to try and weigh up those different outcomes and see whether whether your policy has met the objectives. Now, there are programs which don't care about the area and want to build the industry, and for those policymakers, displacement is much less important than ones where they're trying to build the local industry out. So some of this depends on your objectives. Mm. But it's much more complicated than just a set of positive feedback loops. It's kind of tricky to parse out.
Brilliant. So if that gives us an overview of why policy in relation to clusters is very enduring and how we should think about them, let's talk about and focus on the specific place, the specific cluster that you evaluated, which is Tech City, otherwise known as Shoreditch and Clerkenwell, otherwise known as, you know, the City Fringe. Just give us a potted history of the place, and then we'll get on to what the policy was ultimately trying to do. Just so paint a picture of, you know, the nature of the place that is the City Fringe, Shoreditch, Clerkenwell.
Sure. So what we're talking about is a set of neighbourhoods at the intersection of Islington, Hackney, Tower Hamlets in the City of London. So as you say, it's basically Shoreditch and a bit of Clerkenwell. The exact boundaries of the area are, you know, to be decided. I draw a line around the area in the paper, but we can talk about that later. And it's an interesting set of neighbourhoods. So back in medieval times, it was outside the city walls. It's evolved historically as a kind of area of light industry and craft manufacturing. Had a hard time in World War II. developed into a relatively deprived sort of light industrial and residential area, and sort of emptied out to some extent by the 1980s. So by the kind of 80s to early 90s, it was a classic kind of inner urban part of London, which was relatively well connected, relatively central, you know, deprived, but had a lot of the preconditions for gentrification and neighbourhood change. And then a number of things happened. So, you know, one trigger of change was creative industries in Shoreditch and Clerkenwell looking for cheaper places to live and moving from west to east. So change in Clerkenwell in the early 90s was a sort of early signal that stuff was going to happen in Shoreditch. There was also quite a lot of loft-style accommodation and actual lofts in the area, which started being converted by some of the earliest kind of loft development companies in the late 80s and early 90s. And also a number of kind of artists moved into the area because they had cheap space to build stuff and make stuff and paint stuff. And on top of that, a kind of nightlife emerged out of the area. The economic community that I'm talking about comes out of the creative industries and the way those sort of morphed into so-called new media and then dot-coms in the late 90s and 2000s. So after the dot-com crash, there was a kind of survivor community, many of whom lived in the neighbourhood as well as working in it. Some of them lived in the area and worked at the BBC, which hired a load of tech people to build their website in the early 2000s. And the community basically built organically out of there. It was a bunch of people who knew each other, who worked together, who sort of pitched each other ideas. You know, they would bump into each other on the streets in the interviews we did with these people. And it kind of built up to about 2008. In 2008, somebody tweeted about Silicon Roundabout as a kind of jokey tweet after a party quite late at night. It got picked up by the FT, got picked up by the Evening Standard. There was a sort of huge and escalating media buzz around this thing, rather ahead of the reality on the ground. But that kind of media exposure helped to attract more firms in. And so by the time David Cameron turned up and launched the Tech City program in late 2010, there were quite a lot more firms than, you know, had been there a few years before.
And so this, you know, it's another example of a 20 or 30 year kind of overnight success that the government then spots and thinks this is a jolly good idea. Maybe we can make some, you know, we can make some good media out of this.
Yeah, I mean, we found when we talked to tech firms in the area, so this is an early paper I did with Emma Van Doorn and another one with Emma and Georgina Voss, we found quite a big split between the people who'd been there since 2001, 2002, who were, you know, quite sceptical of policymakers coming in, thought everything was working fairly well, didn't like the Tech City language, you know, preferred using Silicon Roundabout or their own terminology, and people who'd read about it in the paper and come in after 2010, who were much more enthusiastic about it and didn't necessarily know any of the people who'd been there before. So there's a kind of narrative about an insider community accidentally breaking the story open and triggering a policy response, as you say. And then there's a much bigger sort of wave of firms who come in and around the launch of the policy, who don't necessarily have any connection to the kind of early tech community.
Okay, so that's super helpful. And gives us a great oversight. So let's just turn then to your study itself. And before we get into what you did and how you did it and what you looked at, just characterise the government's policy in relation to Tech City. I mean, what was the Tech City policy?
So the policy mix was partly about marketing and branding, partly about encouraging inward investment, partly about the business support and sort of promoting networks between firms, and partly about tax breaks and then tying together delivery. So there are a number of different elements, and some of these things were things the government was planning to do anyway, but either kind of repackaged or refocused them on these industries. So the kind of tax breaks to early stage investors, things like entrepreneurs' tax relief, were national programs, but it was anticipated that their footprint would be quite of Shoreditchy and quite techy. Other things were, you know, designed from scratch to treat the area in the jargon that we would use.
And if we compare that sort of approach to, I don't know, the approach you outlined, you mentioned earlier on in regards to At 22 Barcelona, or even the public policy approach to Silicon Valley, just, I mean, paint a picture as to where the Tech City program would sit in that spectrum.
That policy mix is very much at the light touch end of the spectrum. So it's, you know, it's distinctive. partly because of its emphasis on her branding and marketing and drawing attention to the area over, you know, concrete action, frankly. But it, you know, most closely resembles the Comporter approach, which is that you try and understand the area and you try and tweak it and go with the grain. This is something that Cameron talks about repeatedly when he launched the initiative. He didn't want to go in with overkill. He wanted to go with the grain and help the sort of market processes work better. So that makes it very different from what was proposed in Barcelona, where a whole neighbourhood was rezoned, and these kind of existing industry cluster methods, which would be run at the national level rather than the local level. I mean, there's an interesting footnote to this, which is the original Tech City programme also had an idea to link up Shoreditch to the Olympic Park, and specifically to find uses for some of the buildings in the park after the Games. It was never clear how that was going to work, and it was very much in tension with this idea of going with the grain. It was much more like kind of Barcelona-style master planning. And that basically disappeared and went away within about 18 months. What's there now, which is the Here East development, has, you know, come up as a thing on its own, which is sort of positioned as a sort of extension to Hackney Wick, rather than anything to do with Tech City down the road. I mean, it's a competing site in some ways for, you know, developers and property owners who want firms to be in Shoreditch.
Excellent. Okay, so what's the researcher's challenge when you're trying to address this kind of policy?
So the classic way that researchers go about this kind of policy evaluation is you find some areas that look similar and look at what happened to them over time and compare that trend with what happened in the area over time. So the fundamental challenge is you want to know what would have happened in the area without the policy. But as you lack a time machine, you know, you can't go back and pretend the policy hasn't happened. You have to reconstruct the counterfactual in the jargon. So doing that approach where you find similar places and look at how they change over time and look at the difference in the trends is the kind of usual starting point. So we call this difference in differences. It's a very old technique. It actually goes back to the late 18th or 19th century, I think. I need to get the date of the John Snow study. What is tricky here is, firstly, it's not clear what the area is. So as we talked about before, there's no fixed boundaries. So working out comparator areas is quite tricky. Another one is that even if you do impose a boundary, so if we say that this is we use sort of small administrative units, it's quite difficult to find other tech hotspots in London that actually look similar on observable characteristics. So that's kind of surprising. I would have expected, given the number of tech hotspots around the city, that we'd find some that look sufficiently similar, but actually they don't. If we run diagnostic tests and try and pick, you know, restricted the ones that are most similar, they're not really similar enough. And then the third issue, which is a slightly trickier one to grasp, is that we would say the area is selected. So it wasn't chosen at random. It was, you know, the kind of origin story was maybe quasi-random, but basically it was picked by David Cameron and George Osborne and other policymakers because they thought it was a hotspot and they thought it had growth potential, which was unusually strong compared to the rest of London. So they were convinced by the kind of origin story we talked about earlier. And some of that we can control for in the data, but there may well be unobservable things that determine that selection, but also determine how well it does. And that means that we can't be confident that just comparing on observables is going to give us the true policy effect.
Yeah, which is ultimately what you're trying to get at, right? It's not just a description of how the place has changed, so it's not even a before and after. It's, you know, it's a before and after controlling for what might have happened anyway.
That's exactly it. So what I ended up doing, having played around with these various methods, is plump for what we call a synthetic control. So what I do is I take the tech hotspots that most resemble Shoreditch area before the policy comes in, and I make a weighted average of them. I mean, I say an algorithm does it for me. So what I want to do is I want to predict what happens in Shoreditch before the policy using a synthetic control or a synthetic Shoreditch. So I'm taking the best weighted average I can to predict, for example, the number of tech firms, the number of jobs in tech firms, the kind of the revenue of those tech firms. And my synthetic control will work well if I can plot it on a graph and show that it basically tracks what Shoreditch does before the policy comes in. And then I can run it forward and say, all right, here's what actually happened in the Shoreditch area after the policy, here's what happens or what the algorithm predicts my synthetic Shoreditch will do. The difference between those, if there is one, is the policy effect. Mm. And that's as close as I think I'm going to get to reconstructing the counterfactual. I mean, to get really into the weeds, one of the things this method does, which is useful for this use case, is that it controls for those time-varying, unobservable things that difference and difference can't do. And that means that I can be more confident that I'm actually getting a true policy effect rather than picking up something which is, you know, in the error term, basically, in the other method.
And if I'm right, your starting point, you go back to 1997 mm-hmm. and run the data essentially through until the policy comes in, yeah. and then essentially onwards through till 2017. Is that right?
Yeah, I do what the data allows. So I'm using a nice workplace level data set which starts in 1997. It would be interesting. There's another paper, I guess, where you could go back a lot further and look at the kind of various previous versions of the cluster when it was, you know, in the 80s and in the 70s and so on. But the data doesn't allow that very easily.
Okay, so what else in terms of the methodology do we just need to understand in terms of then when we think about the findings?
So I guess there's a couple of things to flag. One is I have to define the cluster somehow.
Yep.
So I've talked about how difficult it is to do that. What I've ended up doing is saying it's basically a 1 kilometer zone around Old Street Roundabout. So Silicon Roundabout is the kind of, you know, iconic image of the area.
Yeah.
And I basically just draw distance rings until I get to a kilometer. So that takes me back towards Clerkenwell, takes me sort of up into Hackney proper, down towards the sort of Moorgate and the edge of the city. And I picked that number because it basically reflects what people told us when we talked to them on the ground. And it's the kind of thing that you're not going to pick up unless you've done some exploratory qualitative work beforehand. Yep. The other issue is defining tech.
Yeah.
And that's tricky.
Yeah.
So what I've done is gone for a rather conservative definition. And it's conservative, but it also fits the kind of the times. So I've used Office of National Statistics definitions. I basically have two kind of bins of tech firms. One is what I call digital tech, which is basically hardware, IT, and sort of software programming. And the other is digital content, which is basically, you know, creative and design industries which are now multi-platform and use a lot of, you know, digital technology of various kinds. And Shoreditch is, you know, relatively speaking, full of those guys relative to hardware and IT. So, you know, Silicon Valley had a lot of people actually making chips, and making boards, and making computers, at least, you know, in the 80s and early 90s. Shoreditch has never really had that, but it's had a lot of design and print firms that have, you know, evolved into people making online cards, for example, online business cards.
And is there a sense in the literature that you've looked at, or, you know, more broadly, that depending on, in this instance, the type of tech activity that we see, that somehow may have then implications for the results of the findings? Is there anything in the literature around that?
I mean, I think intuitively you might expect that the more mature part of the cluster might benefit more from the policy because it's sort of better embedded. And the firms are larger and more experienced and have more capacity. I think from the kind of literature, you might want to think about this idea of branching. So this comes from evolutionary economic geography, and it basically says, right, if we look at how clusters tend to change over time, they're, you know, it's often less kind of radical shifts than incremental shifts. So, you know, a design firm might start to do, you know, website design, or it might start to offer its products online and customer, you know, and allow people to kind of customize how those things are, you know, designed and produced, do short runs, and go down a kind of open innovation thing where it builds a kind of online community. We can see examples of that. So kind of MooCards, which is one of, you know, now quite a big company in the kind of design space and is working with Microsoft and so on, started out as a kind of business card printing firm, but operating mainly or entirely online in the Shoreditch area. In the 2000s, and it will have come partly out of the kind of design and print heritage of the area. So you can see, you know, there's a branching argument says that there are kind of different versions of a cluster which are related, and you can often see multiple ones on the ground. And again, that would suggest that it's this kind of digital content people who would benefit more. In opposition to that, you could argue that, you know, big cities and clusters are particularly good for people who want to experiment. So this is a nursery cities argument, which is really kind of Jane Jacobs one. Mm-hmm. So it basically says, you know, if you want new ideas, big city or a kind of dense, you know, diverse economic environment is where you want to be, and you want to experiment with that. So actually a cluster policy that tries to draw people in and densify the cluster very rapidly, which is what the tech city policy would arguably do, might well benefit people who are coming in and trying very new things, although that's then going to be a very kind of messy process.
Okay. So let's turn to what you find, and you've hinted at what we might expect given the literature and the theory from elsewhere. So let's just talk through the findings. I think so. Two things, I suppose, just to get your idea. Findings in relation to the change that we've seen over time in the place, and then what we think we can say, or what you can say about the effect of the policy.
Sure. So, I mean, the first thing you see is that the cluster is bigger and denser than it was before. So you can see that if you just run a time trend and don't care about controlling for anything, you just look at what happens over time.
Yeah.
When you look at sort of productivity, and by productivity I just mean kind of revenue per worker, so it's a very crude method, it's a lot spikier. The data is noisier there, but it doesn't seem like you see such an obvious trend. And that is true whether you look at sort of the more established digital content firms or whether you look at the kind of newer, younger digital tech firms. And when you actually go to run the regression, so this is where you're trying to get a policy effect controlling for other stuff that's going on, I mean, that stuff broadly holds up. So I find that compared to what would have happened, so compared to the kind of no policy counterfactual, just continued sort of organic development, the sort of size and density of the cluster goes up. So we add about 108, we add exactly 108 digital tech workplaces and about 1,100 digital tech jobs. We add about 370 digital content workplaces. This is the kind of the bigger part of the cluster to start with. I actually don't see a significant effect on digital content jobs. For density, I see significant effects on both parts of tech, but the shifts are very, very noticeable for the kind of digital tech part, which is the more, you know, the more tech and the less kind of creative industries part of the cluster space. So there, you know, workplace density goes up about 20%, and job density, which is like the share of those jobs, overall jobs, goes up about 80%. So there's a real kind of crowding in of these very core kind of technology firms into the cluster after the policy happens, from a small base, but, you know, equally real and kind of robust changes.
So the magnitude effects, you know, in sense of the scale effects are, you know, are significant,
yeah,
you know, post 2010.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, from a policy point of view, those are the kind of inputs you want to see.
Yeah.
So the kind of the positive feedback loop that policymakers hope they're going to get, I would imagine, is, you know, policy that encourages entry and then tries to, you know, connect up firms and in some cases make them more productive through business support should, you know, give you this loop from a bigger, denser cluster, more effective interactions, and then higher productivity. The risk is that you densify the cluster, it gets more expensive and you have more competition, and that might sort of wash away any productivity effects. When I go on to look at the sort of productivity impacts, they're weaker and they're less consistent. So for these digital tech firms who've been crowding into the area, I basically find an effect which might well be zero. So there's a number, but it's not, you know, statistically significant enough to be confident it's a real one.
So there's more firms in the place, noise, you know, as expressed as you know, units and or jobs, but productivity is much spikier, which is primarily probably to do with some form of competition in some respects.
I think that's partly it. I mean, so the issue for digital tech firms is that there's just, you know, there's just not enough difference between what actually happens versus what would have happened.
Right.
So that sort of could be zero number is just coming from, you know, not a big difference between the real trend and the sort of and the synthetic trend. For the more established tech firms, I do find an impact in one specification, but when I, you know, play around with the specification to check whether it's real, it basically disappears. So I think there's a couple of things that might be explaining that. I mean, one is that if there are productivity effects, they're just going to be bigger for the more established firms, like we said before. So it's a kind of incumbents over entrants effect. I think for the, you know, for the sort of newer, smaller guys who are coming in, there's probably a couple of things going on. One is that there's a lot more churn in the cluster. So if I look at entry and exit, you know, you see a lot more of that than before the policy happened, and it's driven by people coming in, and particularly people coming in from the rest of the UK. So it's a much more kind of competitive environment. One thing you think that might produce is a sort of creative destruction scenario. So this would be where there's lots of churn, but the winners are the kind of the most innovative ones, and the losers kind of disappear. So I test for whether there are any high growth episodes in firms, which is a sort of way of trying to get at that, and I don't find it.
Right.
So it feels like it's more pure churn rather than, you know, kind of...
It's not an upward shift where the churn is essentially the creative dynamic where better is replacing less good.
Right. I mean, it's possible that, you know, I'm looking at high growth in terms of revenue and jobs.
Yeah.
And it may be that I'm missing some, you know, innovation wave that's happening further up the track.
Yeah.
You know, so my post period in the jargon is about, you know, 5 or 6 years. And it's possible that if we came back and run the study again in 10 or 15 years, we'd pick up, you know, firms emerging out of this kind of, you know, out of the sort of the soup of the ecosystem. In a way that I'm not picking up here.
Yeah.
You know, not all tech firms grow through revenue, for example. So
That's
quite an important caveat. But on the face of it, you know, if you're a policymaker, you also want this to be a job-generating intervention, and I don't see that. The other thing which I think helps explain some of that is you see a lot of spatial disruption or sort of spatial moves within cluster space. So here what I do is I take these 250-metre distance rings and look at whether the share of tech firms and jobs is going up or down in each one. And basically, the digital tech guys, the sort of younger entrants, tend to crowd right into the space around the roundabout, exactly where you would imagine them to go if they're trying to get to the core of the cluster.
Yeah.
Whereas the digital content firms seem to be moving out towards the periphery and deconcentrating. So some of that kind of cluster breakup, or, you know, crowding and cost rising right in the middle, I think explains some of the kind of lack of productivity effect.
And so were you also observing, you know, price increases in terms of rents going up in the area as it became more popular?
Yeah, absolutely. So what I don't do in the paper, and this may be, you know, an add-on or another paper, is try and tie that in a structured way. But if you just run the time trend, again, you can see, you know, commercial rents in the area were significantly cheaper than other areas nearby. Over time, that advantage disappears. And I think if you went to look now, you would find it was just as expensive in a, you know, fancy office near the Old Street roundabout as it would be in Clerkenwell or possibly even Holborn.
Yeah.
So that kind of cost advantage of the area has really disappeared. Where it's shifted back a little bit is in the growth of co-working spaces.
Right.
So, you know, one of the sort of property industry responses to all of this has been to take space and kind of cut it up and give people shares in it. So when Emma and George and I were writing one of our papers, we would try and work in cafes in the area to try and sort of pick up some of the atmosphere. It became harder and harder and harder to do that because the cafes got fuller and fuller of people with laptops trying to run their businesses. Many of those will now be in incubator spaces or co-working spaces.
Yeah, workspace with coffee on the side rather than the other way around. Just come back to the point you just touched on a moment ago. It seems to me the part of what the policy was doing was a sort of signalling, marketing, awareness, a raising, sort of just the idea that this area actually exists. And you mentioned that that seemed to be a signal that was being picked up by predominantly UK-based firms. Is that right? Is that what you found?
Yeah, absolutely. I had a look at whether foreign-owned entrants were part of the story, because I think one of the original policy aims was to try and get really big foreign firms in. So there was some, you know, talk at the time that Twitter might locate its UK headquarters in the area. That, I think, didn't work out because at the time there just weren't enough big offices, big floor plate spaces for people to come in. So, you know, Google has gone to King's Cross because it's been able to build an entirely new office in the way that it was, you know, harder to do around there. But you also don't really see that foreign entry story when you go, you know, further down the size distribution and looking at SMEs, which is largely what I'm looking at here. It's mainly a UK story.
So let's turn to, I think two sets of reflections, which you touched on a little bit. One is set of reflections for policy. You know, as you said, kind of deep skepticism in some parts of academia about just this whole area. But superficially, at least, if you're a policymaker, you know, there's a bigger cluster there today than there was, you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. It's a win. So your reflections on the policy questions, and then I'm really keen to get your reflections also on, you know, the approach that you've adopted in terms of the methodology and what that means for evaluation and how we go about this sort of policy-related activity more generally. So policy implications or reflections?
So like you say, I think if you just want a bigger cluster, you know, you can tick this one off. So Boris Johnson, who was mayor of London at the time, you know, as far as we can dig out kind of clear policy objectives from his speeches, he seems very keen on the idea that it should just be as big as possible. Mm-hmm. So I think he would be quite happy seeing these results here. If you want a better cluster as opposed to just a bigger one, I think you'd be much less happy with what you see here. I mean, you've got a policy that has been surprisingly successful given how kind of low cost it was. You know, the emphasis on sort of marketing and place branding you wouldn't imagine would be terribly effective, but actually, you know, repeatedly talking about it from a kind of national policy platform appears to have had real effects in driving people in. That's quite interesting. In terms of, you know, generating more sort of finely tuned firms that do better and are job generating, I think it's been much less good. And some of these, you know, worries about overheating, which I think are real, are problematic. The other thing is, you know, you find quite a lot of these effects happening before the policy comes in, which is in a way is not surprising.
No.
So, you know, David Cameron gave his sort of Tech City speech launching the policy in 2010. We'd already had 2 years of positive media coverage, and this was a kind of growing cluster anyway. So it would be surprising if you didn't see some kind of change going on, given, you know, the amount of buzz that was around the area. In the back of the paper, I think I have a Google Trends time series somewhere which sort of shows this buzz taking off before the policy happens. The tricky thing is that if you, you know, if you do a kind of back of the envelope exercise and look at the size of the policy effects before and after the policy comes in, they're often smaller after the policy comes in. So that suggests, you know, either overheating or, you know, to be sort of more technical about it, weakening the net benefits of being in the cluster for the average firm, particularly for these kind of digital tech firms who took the idea of Tech City seriously and really kind of came in. It doesn't seem to have worked out so well for them. On the other side, I mean, there is, you know, it's very clear that this has helped, you know, London brand itself as a tech destination. So for all of the kind of winners and losers in the area, it certainly helped put London on the map as well as it was Shoreditch on the map.
Yeah, and taking a step back, what does it tell us about the relevance of clusters and cluster policy more generally? Because as you say, there's a spectrum of, you know, this stuff shouldn't be touched versus, well, we can do some things, but we probably need to be much more nuanced and thoughtful about particular interventions. Because in a sense, the Tech City program was a light touch, going with the grain, you know, multi-aspect really, I suppose. So what's your reflections on, you know, where that leaves us with cluster and cluster policy more generally?
I mean, if you look at the evidence that we've got on cluster policy evaluation, and there isn't very much of the stuff where we have, you know, most evidence of effectiveness is this first family of kind of industry partnership approaches. So for mature clusters, bigger firms, basically, you know, grants and loans and incentives to get them to work together and try and generate those cluster dynamics. That kind of thing is, you know, more or less where the sort of policy for the Tech City area is going now. So if you look at Tech Nation, most of the programs they run are actually programs like that, but with smaller firms. So they've been particularly interested in scale-ups this year, for example. But it's stuff which might have a spatial footprint, but is quite far away from the kind of Michael Porter cluster vision where you basically do try and zone an area and work in it. So I think that is one of the lessons that we can draw from this, that actually trying to identify firms and working at the firm level or the kind of entrepreneur level, rather than trying to work at the area level, might be a more promising way to go. And as the kind of cluster gets bigger and more mature, then you're going to have to start varying that geography and thinking about national partnerships rather than just London partnerships. I think to flip it around, there's also a set of much more nuts and boltsy things that are actually local government,
yeah,
or kind of London government functions. And if you look at the kind of planning documents that, did, that the GLA has put out around Tech City, they do see it as a kind of planning problem. So here is an area that is growing very fast. We need to think about infrastructure. We need to think about workspace. We need to think about how we're going to make planning permission decisions. You know, this is an area which is a, one of their kind of opportunity areas. And what's actually needed is a set of planning rules and tools, some of which are sort of London level and some of which are borough level, and they need to be able to work well and sort of play well together. And equally, you know, you need to, as far as you can, encourage the private sector to deliver affordable workspace in the area. So that sort of nuts and boltsy stuff is probably the area level component that you need, rather than trying to do, you know, what's actually a very complicated set of interventions in an area which you, you know, don't fully understand and which is moving all the time.
And but do you get a set? What's your view on, notwithstanding, as you say, the sort of variation between, let's say, firm level versus area level activity? It's still useful for us to essentially try to identify where we see these clusters in action, in real terms, and then think about whether we could or we should be intervening.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think the sort of tricky thing here is trying to work out what is the right policy intervention to start with.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, partly made tricky because it's not always clear what the scale of a cluster is or what the sort of stage of it is. So there's an obvious, you know, first step here, which is about, you know, partly about going out and talking to people and partly about trying to, you know, work with data and get a really good, you know, descriptive sense of what is going on in the area. Then I think you have an issue about, you know, what are the steps you need to take to actually get it going? And, you know, we can draw some of that from the cluster policy experience and some of that, I think, from, you know, the broader local economic development toolkit. You know, we know from the work that the What Works Centre has done, and various other people, that there's a whole set of basically incremental policies, you know, for firms, for people, for areas, you know, which don't always have large effect sizes, but we know that they have some effectiveness.
Mm.
And deploying some of those in the right combination is going to be the way that you take it forward. But there's a linkage here, I think, between, you know, cluster policy and industrial policy more broadly, which is, you know, you're going to have an experimental element to this, whether you like it or not. And by experimental, I mean you don't know what's going to work with any confidence, so you need to be ready to, you know, scale stuff back or scale stuff up.
So we've talked a little bit about your reflections on the work that you did for policy in relation to place and to clusters and economic development more generally. Give me your reflections on, you know, the study, the methodology, the approach that you adopted, the implications that has for evaluation in this space more generally, and how the academic community should or isn't responding, and why that might be, Max?
So, and the method is an interesting one. It wasn't the method I originally wanted to use. The kind of standard approach, as we discussed earlier, with these type of programs is to, you know, compare trends in the area where the policy happens versus some areas that look similar on the outside. And there are other cluster evaluations that are able to implement that. Because this was a bit of a one-off, I had to use this more fancy version of that involving the synthetic Shoreditch and all the rest of it. So this stuff isn't straightforward to do, but there's a suite of methods out there that can be used for impact evaluation, as well as other methods that can be used for kind of process and exploratory stuff. So the kind of the tools are there. Like we said at the beginning, I was surprised to see how little academic evaluation there was of programs like this. And I think there are a few reasons for that. I mean, one is that not all academics are kind of motivated to do policy evaluation. There are kind of bigger and more glamorous things that you can do in an academic career. I mean, academics, particularly in the UK, are also very busy. They have large teaching workloads, and research often has to fit around the side. So the kind of pipeline of research coming out, you know, per X of academics is often lower than you might imagine. And then a more kind of nuts and boltsy thing is it's actually pretty difficult to get the best quality data to do this work. So this was work that I started a couple of years ago, and quite a lot of that time was spent trying to get myself access to the data I then used in the research design. ONS has got a lot better at providing aggregate data, but for something like this, which is about a bit of a city, it's quite tricky not to have to go back to the source and use basically the firm level data and build it up into the area that you want, rather than using, you know, ONS units that come off the shelf.
Yeah.
So if there's bigger programs at a city level or regional level, you can do that. And, you know, ONS have been very good at putting that data out there and making it easier to find. So there are a number of reasons, I think, why academics find it tricky to do this. I think the other part of it is about demand, actually. And this relates to, you know, issues that we talk about in the What Works Centre from time to time. So, you know, policymakers don't always want to know whether their policy works or not, to be completely frank. And I think there's probably a relationship between the amount of political capital you put into launching a programme and how public that is, and whether you really want to know the answer to whether it's been effective over whatever timescale.
Presumably you want to know the answer if the answer is this has been an amazing policy, it's all down to you, Minister.
Very much so, yes. And sometimes that is the answer, but that doesn't always happen. And the other part of it, which is more about the division of labour, I think, is that the kind of policy cycle that government uses, so the so-called ROMEF template, basically has design at the beginning and evaluation at the end. And personally, I find that deeply unhelpful because it basically encourages civil servants, you know, many of whom are very capable of doing these evaluations themselves, to put the evaluation bit in a box and come to it several years in. And by that time, it may be too late to design and deliver the best evaluation that is feasible in theory, because you've made choices about the data you gather, how you rolled out the programme, you know, how much you talk to the people involved in it, that make it harder to do the evaluation. So kind of syncing up the policy design bit and the evaluation bit is going to make it much more likely that you'll get a good evaluation done and do an evaluation in the first place.
Yeah, and I mean, this is a policy area that you and I, you know, have been working on for a long time, and, you know, it's deeply important to us, but it's deeply important more generally in the policy conversation and in this space. And I suppose when you think about, you know, you mentioned the ONS, you know, notwithstanding imperfections and work still to be done, you know, since the Bean Review, which gave them a good kick in, particularly on subnational data and presentation, I think they've made great strides in trying to open up some of the data, make it more accessible to institutions like yours and mine. And that was very much responding to a demand by government in order to do that. When you look at that development, ONS, within government, but also, I suppose, the big data movement, the new techniques, are you more optimistic that we can get better at doing these kind of evaluative pieces, you know, when we look at these sorts of schemes in the next, you know, 2, 3, 5, 10 years?
Broadly, yes. I mean, for this kind of thing specifically, so the paper that I've done, what we need is a way for, you know, researchers to access serious microdata at scale. So here I'm not talking about the kind of aggregate stuff at city level, at regional level, that the ONS puts out. I'm talking about the data underneath it, which is used to build those aggregates. So there is a sort of ONS portal to get at that data, but it is time-consuming and slow, and you have to go and sit in an ONS building at the moment in order to access it. And that's, you know, profoundly disabling to anyone who's not in central London or in Newport or in any other of the few places where ONS operates. So it's very difficult for, you know, people working in LEPs or people working in towns and cities around the country to get hold of that. There's another version of it which does sit on your desktop, which I use, but which is, you know, frankly a victim of its own success. It's extremely slow and cumbersome now to work with it, and if you're doing something that is time limited, where a policy decision has to be made, it's quite hard to get it, you know, to get it done in time, or to be able to guarantee that you can get it done in time. So overhauling that sort of pro end of the data infrastructure is a really important task, I think, which the Bean Review touched on, but which needs to be picked up by ONS and also by, you know, by government departments which support it. I mean, more broadly, thinking about the types of data that are available, I think there's a really positive picture. The world is full of people doing interesting stuff with, you know, administrative data linked together, or data taken from the web, or kind of found in the wild and processed using various types of machine learning. The open data sort of movement in the UK has helped that. So there are a number of companies that use Companies House, which is now kind of fully online and open, to build their own data sets, which are stacked on top of that. And that's a result of a conscious policy choice. So, you know, personally, I find that sort of stuff interesting, exciting. I think there will be a lot more of it. Part of the issue is going to be making sure there are kind of common standards and quality control on some of that data. A lot of the work is being done by, you know, small and highly entrepreneurial companies which are building a business. They're not professional statisticians, and, you know, we shouldn't hold them to those standards, but there's clearly a lot of collaboration and linkage that could be done to, you know, make that data useful for researchers and policymakers as well as business leads.
Fascinating time ahead. My guest today has been Dr. Max Nixon. Max, thanks for being part of City Talks.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre for Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.